Thank you very much for that introduction. It's fantastic to be here. I just also want to acknowledge that UWA is situated on Noongar land and that the Noongar people are still the cultural custodians of their land. And I want to acknowledge and pay respect to their elders, past, present and emerging, and their ongoing struggles against colonialism. Sovereignty was never ceded. We're talking about the Himalaya this evening, and it's a region where a great deal of peoples, cultures are being transformed, and so it's important to acknowledge the struggles of Indigenous peoples here and everywhere. So I'd also like to thank the AIIA WA for having me here tonight. I only recently started as a lecturer in international relations at UWA earlier this year, and I also joined the Centre for Muslim States and Societies. Thank you, Samina. And I'm also head of the recently formed Australian Himalaya Research Network, which started late last year, and because of COVID, we haven't really been able to do very much. I'm not sure it's that interesting an institution for you just yet. And the AIIA has also been very generous, and part of my teaching has been in first year in international relations with Samina, and the Institute has been happy to offer memberships to some of our students who perform particularly well during in the units. I'm not sure if any of them actually made it here tonight, but hopefully they can come to some of your events over the next couple of months. So it's also very pleasing to be here at the AIIA because I only moved here from Melbourne in January. I only moved to Perth at the beginning of the year, and it was a very good decision, a far better decision than I could have imagined at the time. But I'm also very, very much aware that this work that I've done, this sort of more interdisciplinary work on the Himalaya, is something that I couldn't do without my network, and particularly the people that I work with at La Trobe. And they're the co-authored on the articles that John mentioned. So my research is as a foreign policy international relations specialist. We also have I'm also a trained historian. But my colleagues, Ruth Gamble, Gerald Roach, and Lauren Gawne, they come from much different disciplinary backgrounds. They're all also currently locked down in Melbourne, and they're dealing with the COVID crisis. They can't leave their homes, and they are also dealing with the crisis that La Trobe is going through as a result of the COVID crisis. So they're having a really difficult time. Obviously, none of them could make it here today, but they all come from different backgrounds. One of them is an environmental historian, one of them is an anthropologist, and Lauren is a linguist. And we came together at La Trobe and realized we were all working on the same region, but from completely different perspectives. And I say this because one of the major points that I want to make tonight is that we can't really understand the Himalaya solely from a sort of geopolitical, international relations, states and security perspective, because culture, ecology and geopolitics are all really deeply enmeshed and connected in the region. And so we need to look at it from multiple perspectives. International relations scholarship tends to focus just on the state-to-state relationships. So that's India's border conflicts with China, India's border conflicts with Pakistan, the trilateral dispute that goes on in Ladakh in particular, which is where I'm going to talk about tonight. And we just can't afford to boil down the region into just its states and societies, because that neglects the crucial role that the Himalaya plays in the global environment, and it also neglects the minoritized and diverse peoples that live there. But I just say this because at brief moments in this talk, I'm going to be channeling these three colleagues. So what am I going to talk about tonight? First of all, I'll talk about the Himalaya in international relations, as it appears in international relations, and try and draw out some of those connections between cultures, ecologies, and geopolitics for you, to argue that there is something of a feedback loop going on, and that feedback loop of militarization, environmental degradation, and cultural destruction is the central drama in Himalayan geopolitics. And that goes well beyond just the states and security issue that we're probably used to hearing about, that international relations tends to highlight. After that, I'll go through the contemporary conflict in India, between India and China, and focus on the region of Ladakh. I'll go through the deeper history of that conflict and then try and draw some conclusions as to what solutions might look like. Because this perspective, this interdisciplinary perspective, leads me to think that fixing the frontier, getting the borders correct, is insufficient to fix the problem. And we need a much more holistic view of the conflict, and that requires more holistic solutions. So, how does the Himalaya look in international relations? I think this map is a pretty good visualization of how international relations theorists think about the Himalayan region. So you'll see there, this sort of, we have capital cities marked on the maps, we have the contested borders, we have the line of control and the line of actual control between India and China. We know where the border disputes are. We have Arunachal Pradesh being claimed by China as part of Tibet. But what this misses is that only one of the local cities is marked on the map. We have done Srinagar. The capital cities are marked there, but the main problem here is that it looks flat. It looks like any normal lowlands region of the world. And so we have here Nepal and Bhutan talked about as buffer states. We have lots of analysis of what strategic elites in Delhi, Beijing, and Islamabad are thinking. We have the military tension, we have strategy, we have counterinsurgency movements. We have the effect of nuclear weapons. China, of course, India and Pakistan are all nuclear powers. And we tend to only ask one question. Are they going to cooperate or are they going to fight? Under what circumstances will they fight, and then when will they make up? And although this is really indispensable, like we need to have this to understand the region, it misses a huge amount that leaves out, and that distorts our perspective. So this is what I think IR tends to miss about the region. So this is indispensable, but it's insufficient. It misses the role that the environment plays in the conflict. It also misses the ways in which the environment is sort of degraded and damaged by the conflict, by the militarization, by the building of dams, by the infrastructure boom, which is really central to the causes of the current tensions. And it also erases the cultural diversity of the mountains because it focuses on those strategic elites in Delhi and Beijing. So IR does a good job. Diplomatic historians have done a really good job of looking at the history of these borders, how they came to be where they are, and how foreign policy elites saw one another between India and China and Pakistan. But it doesn't go deeper. It doesn't ask these sort of critical questions about how did the borders come to be where they are? Why did the Himalaya come to be seen as a natural boundary between India and China? And these, I think, are more complicated, more difficult questions once we try and dig into them and answer them, then we start to realize that we need much different solutions than just fixing the frontier or correcting the borders. So to do that, we need to go quite a long way back. So the Himalaya is caused, it exists, because 50 million years ago, the Indian continental plate crashed into the Eurasian plate, forcing the territory and the rocks upwards, and that creates the Himalaya that we know today. Now, some of the conflict is more complicated because this is still happening. The Himalaya is still rising. We often hear about India's rise to power, China's rise to power, the rise of Asia more broadly. The Himalaya is the only part of Asia that is literally rising. So that's important partly because of what you see on this map, which is all the rivers that come out of the Tibetan Plateau, and I'll talk about them in a second. But because the mountains are still rising, they rise, you know, scientists debate this about sort of 5 to 10 centimeters a year, but then they lose some of that in silt because the rocks are rubbing up against one another, so they rise, but some of that comes out of the ground and comes out in these rivers, and that leads to super fertile rivers. That makes rivers particularly useful for agriculture, which is one of the reasons that so many human beings in the world live in this region. So we have here the Indus, Sutlej, the Ganga, the Yalantsampa, Brahmaputra, the Irrawaddy, the Salween, the Yangtze, the Yellow River, all of these rivers sustain a huge amount of human life. And they're part of the reason that there are 1.4 billion people in India and 1.4 billion in China and such densely populated regions in Southeast Asia. Now, the ice caps maintain these rivers, but the Himalaya also plays a really important role in producing the monsoon every year. And the monsoon is caused in part by hot tropical winds coming up from the south and hitting the ice caps and then coming back down as rain. And this combination of yearly glacial melt in summer and monsoonal rains in the monsoonal period leads to these perennial rivers. And the silt flows mean that they're particularly good for sustaining agriculture. This provides water for almost half the world's population. Now, because there's so many peaks and valleys here, it's also incredibly diverse in terms of its biodiversity. It's the intersection of three biodiversity hotspots, and it's also a real centre of cultural, human diversity as well. Now, this is a picture that my colleague Ruth Gamble took when she visited Ladakh. I was there late last year. This is a picture of a glacier in Ladakh, and what you'll see there is that it's covered in soot. This happens for a number of reasons. It can happen because there's so many army trucks and power generation. Sometimes the Indian Army uses diesel generators and that produces a lot of soot that can cling to glaciers. There's also global wind patterns that tend to pick up pollution from across the Middle East through Pakistan, and sometimes that gets swept up and blows onto the Himalayas. And the problem with this is that when a glacier is covered in soot, it turns black. And when it turns black, it sucks in heat. White ice reflects heat. So this kind of thing leads to accelerated glacial melt. And this is one of the reasons that some scientists talk about the Himalaya as melting, as having its temperatures rise at higher than usual global averages. So this is an example of the kind of environmental destruction that we see in the region. And all of this geopolitics that I'm going to talk about later takes place in a backdrop of global warming. So this is a picture from Punjab of the Himalaya. Because that map I showed you looked so flat, it might seem like a really obvious point, but it's important to get a sense of the scale of the mountains here, and that really influences their geopolitics. So some of you might have seen this picture during the rounds a couple of months ago. This is from Punjab in India, and what happened was due to the COVID lockdown, all the pollution cleared and residents were able to see the Himalaya from Punjab for the first time in their lives, for the first time in many, many decades. And what you see here is these lowland populations that live next to these enormous mountains. And what's happening is there are these sort of rapidly urbanizing centers in the lowlands of the Himalaya, and more people have access to the Himalayan peaks as a result of technological changes, of better infrastructure development, the proliferation of airports and rail links into the region. So there's more and more people coming to the Himalaya than ever before, or there were before this year, before all the COVID lockdowns. So this geography has meant that it's been very difficult for lowland populations to actually settle in the Himalaya for very long. There are people who live there permanently, but because of the geography, there hasn't been that much sort of external lowland plains influence in the Himalaya until relatively recently, until the last sort of 50 or 60 years, and that's accelerating even more today, and that contributes to some of the cultural changes. Now, I also like to show this. This is what it looks like without borders. And you can see there that it's an extremely distinct environment with snow-capped peaks at the front. And then it's the Tibetan Plateau rises up and that slowly shifts back down through China and into Xinjiang and northern China. So this is all, the geography here is extremely dramatic. It's an extremely sharp rise up from the plains of India, and that has a really strong influence on the politics. I sort of feel like this is how it should look. Now, on top of that, although I said they're 50 million years old, they're actually considered relatively young mountains as well. And this term here, geological surprises, this comes from a colleague of mine, Mabel Gergen, who found a report from an Indian geologist who said that the mountains are full of surprises. that when we cut into them to build roads, sometimes water just comes flooding out. But what this sort of does means for us now is that the mountains aren't actually that well geologically understood. There's also a tremendous amount of instability. Earthquakes are relatively common, and so are landslides. When engineers try to build roads and rail and airports, they often find that they're slowed down. Mountain passes can take decades to build. And also, because they are unstable, because they move around, rivers that are used as borders occasionally change course. And this happened in Nepal, on the Indian-Nepal border a couple of years ago, and a village found itself suddenly a contested territory because the river had shifted. So this means that territorializing the region's states is genuinely uncertain. The borders do shift. The ice packs grow and then they melt back. The rivers can change course or they fluctuate in height. So there is some genuine sort of, it is very difficult to territorialize this region. And once you start looking at it even further, as we'll see when we get to Ladakh, because the mountains weren't properly surveyed at the time the borders were actually drawn to begin with, it really should call into question the sense of bordering or territorializing this region in the first place. But one thing that I will say as a sort of preface into later sections of the talk, the Chinese state has gotten extremely good at building roads across to Western Tibet and towards the border with Ladakh that is now where we're seeing violence. They've been able to build huge numbers of dams. What they do, as you see in this picture, is they dredge the sand up from the river, turn it into concrete, use the concrete to build the dam, use that to generate power, and then they sometimes also stick a label on it that says this is clean energy, which I'm not entirely convinced by. Now, we also need a sense of the process of bordering and state territorialization. So I'll talk about the specific of Ladakh later, but the process of decolonization really transformed the governance in the Himalaya. So India, China, and Pakistan all came to accept this sort of colonial idea that the Himalaya was really a natural border, natural boundary between China and India, rather than seeing it as a region and mosaic of really distinct cultures and peoples. So they all make territorial claims on their reading of some of the history that I'll go through later. China claims territory based on quite imprecise notions of Tibetan ethnicity, and anywhere that there are Tibetan peoples, China likes to say there that should be China. India bases its claims on the broadest possible readings of British colonial cartography, and Pakistan claims all Muslim-majority territory in South Asia. Now, this is where the placing of these lowland cartographic norms are particularly troubling in the Himalaya, and I think they've contributed to the environmental and cultural crisis that the region faces today. Because the place where they chose to draw the borders, the highest peaks, the ice caps, the rivers, because all of this was done via sort of a connection of tethering of cultural identity to territory, there's only transient populations in some of these regions. So it's very difficult to agree on where the borders should be. And I'll come back to that in Ladakh later. Now, we also need a sense of the cultural complexity of the region as well. So even though it was seen as the natural boundary between India and China, the Himalaya is home to an exceptionally diverse group of peoples. Most Himalayan peoples, particularly those in India, China, and Pakistan, are minoritized within their homelands as a result of being put in with these enormous plains-based states with far larger populations. And infrastructure development is now producing this influx of is enabling this influx of troops and tourists to the region, and the borderlands are becoming more and more connected to the center, and that leads to some cultural transformations, which is important. Now, getting a sense of this diversity is quite staggering. So there's not that many good maps of Himalayan language groups, but you can see in this one, this covers Sikkim, eastern Nepal, northeast India, and Bhutan. And what you see there is this incredible, intense diversity of languages. There is a sort of global pattern of linguistic diversity rising with the terrain, if you like. And you very much see that in the Himalaya with lots of small linguistic communities, linguistic minorities. Now, here's a bit from from the eastern Tibetosphere in China. This covers Yunnan, Sichuan Province, Gansu Province, Qinghai, and it's by my colleague Gerald Roach. And what he found was that there are 48 minority languages, all of which are threatened, just in this. This isn't even in the TAR. This is in the sort of outskirts of historically Tibetan regions. What the Chinese state tends to do with languages is to lump them together. So it takes big groups of linguistic diversity and puts a label on them and says, you're all speaking Tibetan. But as you see here, when linguists look at this or go to these regions, they see tremendous linguistic diversity. And the second map there on the right shows just how many languages in the Himalaya are threatened. That because of the global dominance of English and state-backed languages like Putonghua and Hindi, we see some of these smaller languages being seen as sort of economically useless, which is really, really horrible. And these languages are threatened and they're dwindling in numbers of speakers. Now, I think we should care about the loss of languages just because it's horrific to see so many languages disappearing. I think it's tragic. But attached to this as well, when you lose a local language, you lose a lot of sense of the local environment. You use local practices of looking after plants and animals, and so you lose a lot of ecological knowledge when you lose languages as well. So these things are connected. So this is my sort of very simple visualization of simple argument for what I think is happening in the Himalaya, what I think is the central drama in Himalayan geopolitics, and that is that there is a feedback loop going on between increased militarization, cultural transformation, and environmental destruction. These three things play off each other in the region. This situation is enacting this sort of slow violence on the people and environment of the Himalaya, and this is the key drama in Himalayan geopolitics. So, the threat of war is there. I think personally that it's quite unlikely that there will be large-scale conflict, but this is happening even without that. And this should be really concerning because of the role the Himalaya plays in the global climate, in the global environment, the loss of languages, the cultural transformation, and environmental destruction. And this happens partly through increased militarization. So we can't really understand the region without some understanding of these three things. If we look at it without, say, without the militarization or without the environmental destruction or the cultural transformation, then we are distorting the reality of what is happening in the region. And I say this advisedly because I think a lot of the people who tend to analyze the region in this way call themselves realists. And I don't think that's particularly helpful. So, onto Ladakh and the situation there. So I'll take us through the history of the region first. This is the site of the major clashes between India and China that occurred in June and July last year. So in case you aren't familiar with the region, according to the 2011 Indian census, there are 274,000 people living in Ladakh. So it's very sparsely populated. It is a high altitude desert nestled between India, China and Pakistan. It's divided into two districts, Kargil and Leh, with similar populations. Kargil is predominantly Shia Muslim, and Leh is predominantly Buddhist. And these numbers are really, really fundamental to the politics and territorializing of the region. In 2019, India, the Indian government under Narendra Modi turned Ladakh into a union territory. And this was met with celebrations in Leh and protests in Kargil. So it was divisive. But Ladakh is also known as the land of high passes. Now, the La in Ladakh does mean mountain pass. My colleague Ruth has been digging into the etymology of Ladakh, and she's not convinced that the rest of it actually means land of high passes. But this is the colloquial term in India for it. It's the nickname. And it's called that because it has some of the highest mountain passes in the world. Now, historically, those mountain passes were part of major trade routes. They were known as part of the Silk Road. There was a tea and pashmina trade going through Ladakh. Most of those international high passes have now been blocked off by the border conflict. So So with that reorganization, India released a new political map of India. And what it said there was that, well, they split the old princely state of Jammu and Kashmir into two union territories, Kashmir and Ladakh. So someone asked them, does that mean the parts of Pakistan-administered Kashmir, that like Gilgit, are they now also part of Ladakh? And so they produced this new map, which showed these Pakistan-administered territories as no longer part of Kashmir, but as part of Ladakh. So this is slightly unusual, but this is the kind of cartography that we see in the Himalaya all the time. India, China, Pakistan all draw these kinds of maps. What I think is unusual about this one is that if you look at the top, the light blue territory of Ladakh, it looks flat like the previous map that I showed you. There's no sense of the altitude, but also it just looks kind of empty. The rest of India has all of these major roads and rail ports marked and cities. Here we just have Leh and Kargil and very little infrastructure. So I think that's kind of curious. Now, I already talked a little bit about these historic flows and passes. I'm going to take us back a couple of hundred centuries again. I won't go into too much detail, but Ladakh was a place through which things would flow. It was a sort of place of transience. There were traders coming through. There were various empires rising and falling would come through and exert their influence. But because of the intensity of the winter, it gets down to, you know, minus 20, minus 30 in the winter in the capital city in Leh. This meant that empire people would visit, but they wouldn't stay very long. So when I was in Ladakh, I spent the whole time feeling slightly lightheaded. It's very, very high altitude. And this includes the Qing dynasty, the British, and even the Dogra, who are running the Jammu and Kashmir princely state. So they're drawing maps which show this territory as part of their territory, but they're not really there. And they're definitely not adequately surveying the higher mountain peaks and passes. It's also a real cultural crossroads. And there's lots of migratory birds and yaks as well as the rivers. And these are all things that like to flout international borders. Now, the concept here of a border is really important and quite significant. So I've got there the Ladakhi word for border. And that word, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, unfortunately, is used in all of the early treaties. And all of those treaties are drawn on today by the region states to argue for where the border should be. That word does mean border, but it also means meeting place. And these older treaties, what they would do is they would say that this is a place where we'll check your goods, and we might stop some nasty, nefarious people from passing, but all of the pilgrims are still allowed through. All of the traders are still allowed through. So it's a long, long way from the hard border that we see in the region today. So how did Ladakh become a borderland? I've already hinted at some of the imperial understandings of geopolitics and this idea of the Himalaya as a natural border between two enormous plain states. But Ladakh specifically has its own history of this. So there's some classical scholarship and historical work that suggests that Alexander the Great came to India via the mountains, via mountain passes, via what the British called grooves. They saw the valleys as grooves through which India could be invaded. And they're concerned about Russia invading and learning from this history. So they saw Ladakh and the Himalaya as one of the weakest places in which India is defended. They have really strong hold over the Indian Ocean, but if there's going to be invasion, it's going to come through the Himalayan region. So this is known as the Great Game. And they came up with this concept of rivers and watersheds as sort of objective scientific places to draw borders. So they start trying to survey the mountain passes, trying to understand where the border should be, looking for the sort of objective natural border between India and China. It's a very, very fraught idea when you think about it. The British were worried that the Dogra and the princely state would limit their trading opportunities with China. So they think if you get the border in the right place, then you can establish trading routes between it. Everyone knows what's going on. You can secure your region while also trading and making money. Surveying watersheds in the Western Himalaya is incredibly difficult. It's pretty difficult now, but it's much harder in the 18th century. So a fellow called Alexander Cunningham was commissioned to do this work. And this region includes some of the world's highest mountains, three intersecting watersheds, all with water just tumbling out of them. And his attempts to map the border were not helped by the locals or by the Dogra Empire or by the Chinese. The local people just thought he was being nonsensical. Why would you want to do that? The Dogra and Chinese authorities weren't that interested, but when on reflection, what I think this actually suggests is that they didn't really have that much administrative capacity in the region. They weren't actually there. And so the region gets mapped and the cartography gets done on the basis of a pretty mediocre understanding of the region itself. Now, when decolonization occurs, it's actually when we see an increase in sort of lowland influence in Ladakh and the region. So the two-nation theory splits India and Pakistan, the PRC emerges and claims all the territory of the Qing dynasty on that sort of, as I said before, that quite imprecise notion of Tibetan-ness or Tibetan ethnicity, conflict with Pakistan and China and shuts down the border and trade connections. There's a conflict between India and China in Ladakh in 1962. China invades, takes Aksai Chin and invades Ladakh. It also invaded current-day Arunachal Pradesh. It takes the city of Tawang and then unilaterally draws back but keeps Aksai Chin, so India loses some of the territory that it claims. And this shuts down Ladakh's role in the global economy. It shuts down all of the high passes. Now, after the high passes are shut down, Ladakh finds a different role in the global economy. It becomes a site of first European tourists find it. Ladakh is really, really beautiful, in my opinion. It's got a lovely, sort of interesting culture, and so it becomes a site for tourists. And the Pashmina trade continues, not because the Pashmina are being taken out and sold elsewhere. It continues because people go there and just buy them because they're lovely. My wife is over there wearing one of them. So this process of decolonization leads to much more lowland influence in Ladakh. And the cutting off of the high passes, the stopping of cultural connections between the region, the Pakistan and India both invade the region shortly after after independence as they're in their first war. And Pakistan stops at Skardu and Indian troops reach Kargil, and that has become the hard border ever since. And those Shia Balti communities have families have been split as a result of that ever since. And it's a really hard militarized border. This leads to an increase in communal tensions in the region. The Buddhist Ladakhis develop a much stronger affinity for the Indian state than Muslim Ladakhis did. And at one point in the 1980s, there was a boycott of Muslim businesses arranged by a Buddhist association in Leh. And this is all, I think, partially tethered to the geopolitics, to the demands between, demand the fight over Ladakh's territory. Now, the Kargil conflict, it's often studied in international relations scholarship as an example of what happens when two nuclear armed states go to war. It's a very interesting case study for that, but it has different meaning for the people of the region. It was the first time that they'd actually been fighting between these two states in their territory, in their land, since the first war in 1948. And what happened in the Kargil conflict is that Indian troops used to leave their posts for winter because it was too cold and they thought it was silly to stay up there. It's very dangerous. Still today, more troops die because of the environment than by fighting. And then when they came back, as the snow started to melt, they found that Pakistani soldiers had taken their places and were infiltrating Kargil. And what they fought and eventually pushed them back, the line of control doesn't actually change. But as a result of this, Indian troops learn, you've got to stay there through winter. You've got to stay permanently militarized. You can't leave. and this has led to a permanently perennial year-round militarized border along the line of control in Ladakh between India and Pakistan. I think that's probably where we're heading with the India-China conflict there today, which is not a particularly good result. Now, infrastructure is really central to all of this as well. Infrastructure building is the sort of proximate cause, if you like, for the fighting that happened in Ladakh in the last year or two. Infrastructure in India and the Indian Himalaya is built by the Border Roads Organization, or the BRO. They have these slightly adorable signs all over the highways letting you know that they build them. They're very cute. So Ladakh's infrastructure boom is partly because the BRO is part of the Indian military. So the roads are being built by the Indian state, by the Indian military, and it's to facilitate partly the movement of troops, but it also enables this huge flow of tourists into the region, which changes the region's economy. And it also, it's become almost the sole source of income in Ladakh. Not quite the sole source. But what's happened is because the Chinese state has built so much infrastructure, and I'll show you some images later along to Western Tibet towards Kailash, which is getting close to Ladakh. The Indian state has responded by building its own infrastructure into the borderlands as well. And it seems the most likely explanation for the current conflict has been that the Chinese state was irritated by India building its road too close to the border. So infrastructure has been the spark for conflict in the region. Now, just a little bit of sort of cultural flavor, I suppose. This is a place called the Indian Army Hall of Fame. It's just near the airport, just south of the city of Leh. And what you see there is a statue of the Buddha, and he's flanked on either side by Indian Army howitzers. This is really popular tourist destination for Indian tourists going to the region. You also have a sort of Buddhist stupa behind it. So the sort of Buddhist imagery and the imagery of the Indian Army sit alongside one another at tourist sites. It's a really fascinating and sort of curious juxtaposition of images. This here is a statue of black-neck cranes, which was unveiled in Leh on the 1st of November, and it's marking the establishment of Ladakh as a union territory of India. Black-neck cranes are a part of a Buddhist symbolism. They're seen as sacred by Tibetan Buddhist communities, and so this statue is trying to reflect but also to win the support of Ladakhi Buddhists for the creation of the Union Territory in Ladakh. Now, onto the contemporary conflict. That's some of the sort of cultural transformations that are happening with Buddhist Ladakhis tending to have this really strong affinity with the Indian state and how that folds their cultural icons into the Indian state. So, the conflict here, June 15 to 16 was the first time that Indian soldiers have actually died in combat between China and India in the past 40 years. There was fighting in the Galwan Valley. That's the major instance of conflict. There was also some tension in Pangong Tso. This map here is of Pangong Tso. The Pangong Tso is a militarized lake. It has both the Indian and Chinese navies on it. Even though it's incredibly high altitude. And it's divided up into fingers by the military, and fingers 4 to 8 are the contested territories. The Chinese appear to have built roads up to finger 4, and there are all these encampments that formed over May, June, July of this year as well. So let's have a look at some of those. So these are the areas where there's conflict, at the Galwan Valley, Pangong Tso, and the hot springs as well, so all right along the line of actual control. Now, I'm not sure how well you can see this. It may not be zoomed in close enough for you. Basically, these structures weren't there a couple of months ago. This is the contested territory at Pangong Tso. This sort of geopolitical cul-de-sac here, this road is relatively new. And these structures here, these little red dots, they appear to be sort of Chinese army temporary accommodation. So it's a big surge of troops into the region. Here's a more zoomed in image. When you can see, it's hard to tell exactly what they are from this, but this is evidence of really increased Chinese construction in the region. And this dotted line here is the Chinese claim. So usually the Chinese don't cross this region. But what you can kind of see just here is a little trail that sneaks onto the Indian side. And there's also been a real increase in trucks and construction in this part of the conflict. This is one of the things that tipped the Indians off to Chinese incursions. Now, this is one of the sites that gotten a lot of attention in the Galwan Valley. This little corner is just over the Chinese claim in Ladakh. So this appears to be an expansion of the claim. You can sort of see here this little plateau by the river and the rocks here. So this is what it looked like on May 22. There's sort of evidence of road construction along here and a small bit of infrastructure being built as well. That's May 22. Now on June 22, a month later, there's trucks along the road and some more of those red tent-like structures. Now this section is in India. This is the best evidence that we've sort of been able to find that the Chinese have been expanding their territorial claim, only by, 1 kilometre or two, but Chinese incursions into India. And the other thing that I think is interesting about this is if we flick back here, it looks like there's rock here. I'm not sure when this image was taken. So it looks like they might have, I can't say this for certain, but it looks like they've cut away some of the rock to build the road. I'm interested in your thoughts on that as well, I suppose. Now, and this is where the Chinese infrastructure development in Tibet is really important and significant. I've hinted about this before. I'm not even sure the Indian state quite comprehends just how much Chinese infrastructure development across Tibet has taken place. So this is a dam. This is from a picture that my colleague Ruth took on a tourist trip to Tibet, where she followed the Yalansampo River. And this is dam construction. So the Yalansampo is a really long river. It tumbles into India near Assam, and it flows through into Bangladesh. China's built dams all along the tributaries and some on the river as well. So this concerns India because it means they're concerned that China might control the water flow into India. So that leads to India building its own dams along the other side of the border, and you get into this really troubling sort of infrastructure war where everyone's trying to build as many dams as possible. And the thing that suffers from this is the water, from the watershed. There's very little effective environmental governance of Himalayan rivers. And where it does exist, it's things like the Indus Waters Treaty, which treats the river solely as a channel of water and sort of defines it and constructs it as something from which the state can extract, from which the state can dam or take water from. It doesn't lead to this sort of holistic governance that looks after the health of a watershed. It's governance that leads to the extraction of things from a river. That can be sand. There's a lot of sand mining going on in this part of the world. That can be dams and electricity extracting power, or it can be extracting water for agriculture. Now, this is the competition for dams on the Indus River system. So China only has one at the point that this was made. India has 16, Pakistan has 22, and Afghanistan has 2. And there's this competitive infrastructure development going on, which is really, really damaging for the health of the watershed. Now, this is high-speed rail construction in western Tibet. This is the kind of thing that concerns or worries the Indian state. So we're going to see, once tourism comes back, and we'll see that China's high-speed rail network is really incredible. It's really well developed. The trains are fantastic. And this network is reaching into the further reaches of western Tibet towards Aksai Chin, towards Ladakh, towards the part of the world that we're interested in now. And this will be used for tourists, but it also facilitates troop movement. So this is one of the things that's concerning Indian state and leaving them to build their own infrastructure. And they've been starting to get closer and closer to the border regions. They're getting through their road projects. Now, as I said before, the environment plays a really important role in the conflict because the borders can move. There's genuinely uncertain. There are earthquakes and landslides. There's changes to water flow. There's glacial melt. But it's also just worth mentioning here that more soldiers die from the harsh environmental conditions than they do from the conflict. That's been the case in the India-Pakistan conflict in Siachen. It seems to be. It also happens in the India-China conflict, and perhaps until the recent clashes there. Now, it sounds like the talks that are going on at the moment to pull back are not going particularly well. And so that's why I say that a quite likely result of this is to see a militarized year-long perennial line of control like you see at Siachen Glacier and between India and Pakistan. That is a quite real possibility. So the troops will just stay amassed along the border, they'll stay there all year. Because there's been an increase of Leh's army population, soldiers sleep in dormitories, and there's some reports of COVID sweeping through those dormitories. So that is another problem for the people of the region. But it was also interestingly recently announced that Prime Minister Modi was seeking to make Leh and Kargil and Ladakh a carbon neutral state. There have been similar calls like that made in places like Sikkim going purely organic. There's this. I think this is a positive announcement, and I hope it actually happens. But so dams are still relatively low on carbon, and also construction in concrete is a real emitter of carbon. So I wonder how this will be counted, how it will be achieved. But it's a positive step. Okay. Now, in conclusion, as I said, disengagement talks aren't going particularly well, but I don't think that just finding the correct spot for the borders is going to fix this enough. I would argue for something more extreme and the rethinking of the region along those lines that I've suggested, not of just fixing the geopolitics, fixing the border, but reimagining the region. And other people have made this call. I'm sometimes called utopian or unrealistic, but I would say that thinking that just fixing the border problems will solve all the region's problems, I think that's pretty unrealistic. I think that's kind of utopian as well. What I think needs to happen is the deterritorialization of the ice caps, mountains and rivers to the extent that it is possible. Then that requires really rethinking the region. So disengagement talks aren't going well. I'm not saying this is not a prediction, but at some point, the intensity of the environmental degradation, the way that both states are seeing the environment as something to be extracted from competitively, that is eventually going to start to undo the conflict. If the environment collapses, then the conflict and the state conflict collapses as well. And I don't think that's going to happen soon, but you know, in a longer term frame, you know, over centuries, that is likely to be what happens. So what needs to actually happen to fix this problem is to build regional governance structures that can incorporate local voices and scientific consensus into the decision making. And this might sound kind of utopian, but these kinds of bodies do exist in other parts of the world. The other two largest ice caps, the Arctic and the Antarctic, are governed by these kinds of councils. So there are some precedents for this. And there are also some examples. They tend to stay away from the geopolitics, but there is an international organization working in the region called ISIMOD, and that circulates scientific information around the region. So there is some examples of this. And there are also still some cross-border communities in the region that are functional. There are cross-border communities in the Assam-Bhutan border. There are some still in the Arunachal Pradesh-Tibet border as well. There are examples of these borders working as borders becoming more like crossroads than hard militarized borders. So there are some signs for hope. But I think this requires rethinking the region really thoroughly and recognizing the importance of the Himalayan environment to the world and incorporating local voices in fixing the sort of democratic deficit that exists in much of the Himalaya. And this requires going beyond fixing the frontier. I will leave it there and take your questions. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Alexander. That's fabulous. I really coloured in the map. Well done. We've got time for a couple of questions. Alexander will be coming to dinner afterwards. But can I just see, I'm sure there's a question or two. Brendan. And I'll introduce you. Brendan Augustine just joined our committee, so welcome aboard, Brendan, as a courtesy, telling who he is.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that very rich and multi-layered exhibition of the issues. I guess as a former foreign affairs official, I have to ask the realist question.
Yeah.
What is China's endgame by... What's your opinion of China's endgame by that increased activity, by pushing the boundaries, so to speak? Is it part of a larger geopolitical, multi-frontier kind of action that we're seeing, or is it why pick this part of their border? Why India? Why now?
That's a really important question. I'm not that much of a Chinese foreign policy expert. It's quite likely that you might have a better sense of this than myself. But the timing, in my opinion, it's primarily down to the infrastructure building and that sort of triggering a response from China. Why this part of the border? This part of the border is the part where it is genuinely where the Chinese and the Indians disagree on where the border should be. So on the expedition that I talked about earlier, they found a border post at a village called Demchok that had some suggestion that this is the border between Tibet and India. And it's not much to go on, but that led to the border being drawn in that region. And Demchok is right near where the clashes took place. So I think that there is a genuine border dispute in this region where they have different readings. And the geopolitics of this is a more grand strategy answer that I think is probably what you're after, is a really tense and uncertain geopolitical time at the moment with the coronavirus, with the US-China trade war, with suggestions that India is sort of dragging itself slowly closer to the US. And this is an opportunity for China to say, we are better at building this infrastructure than you. We have better control of this region than you do, and holding that over India's head. That would be my answer to the question of why now and where it is. But I do think that the prime sort of driver, the proximate cause of this is the infrastructure development. And then the context is the COVID uncertainty and China becoming more assertive. So I hope that answers your question. Thank you.
Thanks, Alexander. And time for one more question from Professor Samina Yasmin.
Thank you very much, Alex. A wonderful presentation. I can see where you're coming from. But I'm just thinking, your idea about deterritorializing the whole sort of way of looking at this region, it's like either or. Why can't we do both? Because, picking up on what Brendan's saying, the realist perspective dominates the way states relate to each other. So to tell them and say, forget about this boundary, it's just not going to cut ice.
Well done.
We have to say, okay, these are the boundaries, but there's another layer to it that why can't you understand that and let the people link up with each other? So that might be a way out of this, because I think that's what India and Pakistan border line of control, these were the ideas being floated.
Yeah,
and they started sort of bus service and then they stopped that. So unless and until you bring the realists on board and let them read what's happening in the region, I think you run the risk of being branded as an idealist. But there's a value in it, because what you're saying is look at the land, what's happening. And politics is one thing, but the land is another. So these two need to come together. So
how do we make the switch, the jump between? How do I convince the realists that this is the way to go? Is that?
I mean, now you're asking me a question, but I just think you do need to have willingness on part of all the parties to say we will negotiate and we'll work together. Yes. But that's a long sort of road on which people have to move on, which happens off and on with India-Pakistan example, but then they go back to being negative.
Yeah,
but I think the ideas that you're promoting, they've got value in it. So thank you.
I suppose if you want to make the argument to a realist foreign policy maker in Beijing or Delhi, you've got to say that this is very short-term national interest thinking. But ultimately, if you look at the way that the environment works, the way the watershed works, this is not in your national interest.
Yeah.
This is an unwinnable contest for water resources, for hydrology, that is ultimately going to damage the watershed and lead to worse results for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so there are national interest arguments for cooperating. And then I think you're absolutely right on the sort of soft border element to it, that letting the trade flows restart, letting people visit their families on the other side of the borders, letting these cultural connections that have been dissected by the hard borders, letting them come back together. You're right, that happens occasionally on the India-Pakistan side, and it gets shut down very quickly when tension starts or when there's some form of terrorism or some form of military conflict. But I think pointing to the examples of cooperation that do exist and making a sort of national interest case is, I mean, I am very cynical in many ways. I do not expect this to go well. So it's funny to be called an idealist as a result. But I think it's important to put those ideas out there, because I think ultimately that is a much better solution than just disengaging and then continuing the militarization.
I fully agree with you on that. I just thought you need to marry the two.
Yeah. Maybe I'll write a policy paper on it or something like that.
Well, very good. Look, as you know, Alex is joining us for dinner, so there's plenty of time for your questions. But if I could move from one vice president to another, to Amy, to move a formal vote of thanks on everyone's behalf. But thanks, Alex. Here's Amy Blundell.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. As John said, I just thought, that this evening you took us to a very inaccessible and complex area of the world, and you did it very clearly and with some great pictures and really detailed maps, which really help, paint the picture for us. Easy to read. All the best with the rest of your time here in Perth, and a great asset to have you here now with us. So
thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Alex, for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.